Of nearly 90% of all USAID programs has definitely hit the sector really significantly at a time when humanitarian needs have really never been higher. The funding available for those needs is really significantly contracting.
Despite partial 2025 funding restored after January's initial cuts, Nonviolent Peace Force says critical gaps remain. From wars in Gaza, Sudan, and Ukraine to climate-driven disasters displacing millions, Rogers says they are now racing to protect 2026 budgets through the House Subcommittee Overseeing Foreign Aid, chaired by Florida Republican Mario Diaz-Balart. Rogers warns merging USAID with the State Department, as proposed in a Trump administration memo, could slow critical aid responses, but she points to hope in South Sudan, where she says women from rival communities now work together to protect children from violence.
So that's an example of community organizing that has actually protected a lot of children from abduction, from violence, because women are stepping up and saying that they don't want to be a part of this violence and they want to protect themselves from it. So stepping away from that cyclical process of violence.
As congressional budget negotiations unfold, peacekeeping groups stress that the stakes extend far beyond politics and that millions of lives hang in the balance. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 17th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, Lexis Ponce, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, Judith Ruiz Branch, Mark Moran, Tramell Gomes, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. The U.S. and El Salvador won't return a wrongly deported man. U.S.-Iran nuclear talks have a long way to go, says Iran. And the Trump corruption train never stops. First, the U.S. and El Salvador won't return a wrongly deported man. The outrageous acts from the Trump administration come fast and furious, but none may be more dangerous than this one. In defiance of court decisions, both Trump's Justice Department and the El Salvador government of Nayib Bukele are refusing to return wrongly deported Kilmar Abrego Garcia to the U.S. Even though the U.S. government admits that the deportation was mistaken, and even though a federal judge and the Supreme Court unanimously agreed that the U.S. should facilitate Abrego Garcia's return, both Trump and Bukele are finding every excuse to refuse to comply. The Justice Department says it's not required to return Abrego Garcia, that his return depends on El Salvador releasing him, and that the U.S. is only required to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return when he seeks to re-enter the U.S. Tom Homott, the border czar, boasts that if Abrego Garcia is allowed to return, quote, he will be detained and removed again. As for Bukele, who presides over a notorious prison system and has been roundly condemned by human rights organizations, he says, how can I return him? It's a shabby, disgusting game these two authoritarian leaders are playing, and it puts us in a constitutional crisis. Will the Supreme Court take the next step of demanding Abrego Garcia's return? Trump said he would obey such a decision, but he hasn't obeyed the order to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return. Will a federal judge hold the government in contempt? She says the government has done nothing to bring the man back and seems prepared to depose Trump officials in order to see the records of their actions. But I fear that Trump will use this case as a test of his power, just as he has done with Harvard University, Paul Weiss Law Firm, and Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia student, to see how far defiance of judges can go. Trump even mused, with Bukele sitting beside him, that U.S. citizens who commit violent crimes might be deported to El Salvador. The illegality of such an act hardly fazes him, or Bukele. Attorney General Pam Bondi said otherwise, "We're not going to let people convicted of crimes go anywhere, and if we have to build more prisons in our country, we will do it," she said. Now, isn't that comforting? Next, Iran-U.S. nuclear talks have a long way to go, says Iran. The talks in Oman last Saturday concluded on what seemed to be a positive note. "I think we are very close to a basis for negotiations, and if we can conclude this basis next week, we'll have gone a long way and we'll be able to start real negotiations based on that." That was the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. A White House statement said the talks were a step forward. Trump said aboard Air Force One, quote, "Nothing matters until you get it done, so I don't like talking about it, but it's going okay. The Iran situation is going pretty good, I think." So I guess both sides agree, as Churchill famously said, that jaw-jaw is better than war-war. The Israeli press is reporting statements by Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, that suggest the U.S. position is to cap, not eliminate, Iran's uranium enrichment program, and at the same very low level of enrichment that was specified in the initial nuclear deal under Obama. A New York Times report on April 11, based on conversations with two senior Iranian officials, said that the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, agreed to the talks after close aides warned that the U.S.-Israel threat of attack was real and that failure to engage in talks with the U.S. would lead to regime instability. Specifically, according to the report, the Ayatollah was told that U.S.-Israeli attacks on Iran's two nuclear sites and the onset of war would so destabilize the already weak economy that people would rise up against the regime. With regime preservation on the line, Khamenei reversed his previous decision not to talk with the Americans, though insisting that the initial round of talks be indirect via Oman as an intermediary. Iran is in an unprecedentedly weak bargaining position. Its economy is in a shambles, its proxy forces fighting Israel have been gravely weakened, and neither Russia nor China is in a position to help resist the U.S. U.S. sanctions on China, moreover, would put a big dent in Iran's oil exports to China. Trump holds most of the cards now, including tight relations with Netanyahu's Israel, which has always been eager to attack Iran's nuclear facilities. When Netanyahu was in Washington the other week, Trump seemed to say that the U.S. would dictate an attack on Iran, but that Israel would carry it out. Let's not forget, however, that Trump walked away from the previous nuclear deal in 2018. If that deal had been enforced today, it would have kept Iran from being close to having a nuclear bomb. The Trump corruption train never stops, and here are two stops. First, did Trump engage in market manipulation? Shortly after U.S. stock markets opened on April 9, Trump wrote on his social media platform, "This is a great time to buy DJT." Less than 4 hours later, he shocked investors by announcing a 90-day pause on additional trade tariffs on most countries except China, sending share indexes soaring. Senator Chris Murphy asked, quote, "Trump's 9:30 a.m. tweet makes it clear he was eager for his people to make money off the private information only he knew. So who knew ahead of time, and how much money did they make?" Well, Marjorie Taylor Greene, for one, she made a bundle. And, of course, Trump himself. His media and technology company jumped 21% after he announced the 90-day pause on tariffs. And the second stop, are tariff reductions for sale? No sooner did the Trump administration add to its tariff rate for China than an exception was granted for electronics imports. Was this a gift to Microsoft, NVIDIA, and Apple? Apple was reported to be in danger of huge losses if the 145% tariff on China stuck, since the price of iPhones would have been beyond reach. Expect a big donation from Apple and the others to Trump's war chest. But as for those not exempted from the new tariffs, Senator Elizabeth Warren said, quote, "Investors will not invest in the U.S. when Donald Trump is playing red light, green light with tariffs and saying, oh, and for my special donors, you get a special exemption." In other news, Chinese soldiers were captured in Ukraine. President Zelensky of Ukraine reported that Ukraine had captured two Chinese soldiers during the fighting. Proof of their nationality has been made known to China, which is investigating. It is still unknown whether the two Chinese soldiers captured were mercenaries, were part of a Chinese military unit, or belonged to China's intelligence services. It's also unclear what their actions in Ukraine were before being captured, how many Chinese soldiers have been fighting in Ukraine, or when and how they arrived. If this development is something more than an unofficial act, it would mean that China has broken its promise not to take a direct and active part in the war. Revocation of foreign student visas is more widespread than we thought. According to The Guardian, more than 600 international students and recent graduates in the U.S. have had their visas revoked or their legal status changed by the State Department, according to data aggregated from around the country. The data, collected by Inside Higher Education, shows that as of last week, more than 100 colleges and universities have identified more than 600 cases of students whose immigration status was changed by the Trump administration. These institutions say that their students have lost their F1 or J1 student visas. Various sources are reporting on the climate of fear that has gripped international student communities across the U.S. Concern about visas has led many to wipe out their social media accounts and steer clear of any kind of political involvement on campus. This situation will surely accelerate the decline of foreign student enrollment in U.S. schools that I previously reported. The U.S. and Mexico are engaged in a water dispute. Mexico has failed to comply with a treaty with the U.S. on water deliveries from the Rio Grande to Texas farmers. Under a 1944 treaty, Mexico must send 1.75 million acre-feet of water to the U.S. from the Rio Grande every 5 years. But in the treaty's current 5-year cycle, which is up in October, Mexico has sent less than 30% of the required water, according to data from the International Boundary and Water Commission. Mexico's President Claudia Sheinbaum has assured the Trump administration, which is threatening trade sanctions, that Texas will receive more water. But she points out that Mexico has had to deal with a drought that limits how much water Mexico can actually provide. This dispute looks like it could go either way. Next, Trump's disruption of the International Criminal Court, the ICC, takes a new turn. Earlier this year, the Trump administration ordered economic and travel sanctions against a lead prosecutor of the ICC, Karim Khan, for successfully bringing a war crimes charge and an arrest warrant against Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The order also prohibits U.S. citizens, permanent residents, and companies from providing this prosecutor with services and material support. Now, two international lawyers have brought suit against Trump, arguing that his order is unconstitutional and unlawful, and would put a chill on the lawyers' efforts to work with the ICC. One of the lawyers has been working with the ICC on the Rohingya genocide case in Myanmar, and the other has been seeking prosecution of the Taliban in Afghanistan for its oppression of women and girls. The first lawyer said that Trump's executive order, quote, "doesn't just disrupt our work, it actively undermines international justice efforts and obstructs the path to accountability for communities facing unthinkable horrors." Greenland remains in Trump's sights. The administration continues to insist that it is going to acquire Greenland one way or another. The latest report is that it will do so by convincing Greenlanders, not by using force. Meantime, the commanding officer of the U.S. military base in Greenland has been fired for failing to fall in line with J.D. Vance's contention when he visited the base that Denmark had failed to give Greenland enough support. Colonel Susanna Myers wrote in an email, quote, "I do not presume to understand current politics, but what I do know is the concerns of the U.S. administration discussed by Vice President Vance are not reflective of Pituffik Space Base. The base has Greenland and Denmark officers and flies three flags, as required under a 1951 defense agreement. Colonel Myers said after Vance departed, quote, "I commit that for as long as I am lucky enough to lead this base, all of our flags will fly proudly, together." Now she's another victim of the Trump-Vance disloyalty campaign that has hit the military fairly hard. Next, a positive story for a change, Uruguay's Green Revolution. Natasha Hakimi Zapata writes in The Nation that, quote, "Uruguay has gone from suffering frequent blackout and power cuts to relative energy sovereignty, based almost entirely on electricity generated from a stable mix of wind, solar, hydroelectric, and bioenergy sources," unquote. All citizens and schools have electricity. This energy revolution began in 2008, and by 2018, Uruguay had become a net energy exporter, mainly to Brazil and Argentina. A drought in 2008 provided the spur to creation of a national energy plan, one that married diversity of electricity sources managed by a state agency to social justice, quote, "access to affordable energy as a human right." From 2017 to 2020, she says, 97% of the electricity generated in Uruguay came from renewable sources, making it one of the first countries in the world to reach that level. "Uruguay consumes less fossil fuel today than it did 50 years ago," unquote. Still, there are problems, she reports. One is the high cost of electricity despite the savings from renewables. Those savings are being used to finance other government programs. Another problem is the privatization of wind power by multinational companies, contrary to the hope that the state would own all energy sources. Finally, an update from the Ukraine war. As the Trump administration waits for a Russian response to its so-called peace plan, there are reports of a rift between Trump's clearly pro-Russian envoy to the talks, Steve Witkoff, and his envoy to Ukraine, General Keith Kellogg. Witkoff seems to favor the Russian demand that the four Ukrainian provinces it occupies be acknowledged as a permanent part of Russia. The quickest way to a ceasefire, Witkoff has said. General Kellogg thinks that demand should be off the table, since Ukraine would never agree. Relatedly, Putin issued a decree March 20th to force Ukrainians in those occupied areas to accept Russian law and a Russian passport or be punished. The obvious motivation for the decree is to increase the number of citizens he can claim to be Russian so as to make the occupied territories more legitimately seem to be Russia's. Without a passport, a Ukrainian wouldn't be able to work legally or have access to medical or pension benefits. Russia has used this tactic before in two occupied regions of Georgia, Abkhazia and South Ossetia. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Local Indigenous activist Tracy Molina, who also goes by Koska, recently spoke with KBOO reporter Sam Bowman about her experiences of personal and public protests in Portland. From 2018 to the present, Molina has participated in events including confrontations with right-wing extremists, the months of protests following the murder of George Floyd in 2020 and 2021, and demonstrations for the rights of Palestinians. Over this time, she's experienced and seen a wide range of treatment at the hands of Portland police, county prosecutors, and local and national media, which she says include targeted harassment of activists, evidence that has been falsified or ignored, misrepresentation and doxing by public figures, and pervasive mistreatment of detainees in the county jail. The part of the interview we're airing tonight focuses on her agitation for increased safety and access to medical care and basic needs at the Multnomah County Detention Center, which has led to an ongoing misdemeanor case against her. The full version of this interview can be found on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/eveningnews.
I knew that people were going to die in the jail because, one, I was a corrections officer for a year. I got trained as a corrections officer, worked in a high security prison. I never saw any kind of abuse that what the jail was doing. And then I saw a lot of dangerous behavior by the jail. And I also knew that it was very dangerous because I worked in an inpatient psych unit before and have a master's degree in social work. And so I could tell what they were doing was going to result in death for sure. And no one would listen to me. I was just a crazy person. So I set the alarm off and I told the cops that's responded why I was setting it off, because people were going to die. Then five people died. 60 days, four or five people died in 60 days after I did that.
And you're referring to the kind of spate of deaths in like 2023, 2024.
Yeah, right. Because every time I went to jail, I would see them doing dangerous behavior that was lethally dangerous. I knew that what they were doing would cause a death. Eventually, it would cause a death. I knew for sure.
Could you tell me a little bit more about the alarm incident?
What
led up to that?
So I'm just desperate for anyone to please God listen to what I'm saying, you know, about what's going on in the jail. I mean, it's just such an easy, well, to me, it seems it would be like an easy fix to save people's lives. If you walk into the garage at the jail, it will set an alarm off. And so I just walked in there enough to set the alarm off.
This is at MCDC?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I even recorded it. Because I'm saying on there, when he comes down to get me out of there, I'm saying, like, you got to do something about all the abuse that's going on there. Why don't you care about what's happening to people in there? And I know, like, the house, if that place was on fire and we were trying to save people on the inside, like, we would be allowed to break down the door or set the alarm off to let them know, hey, people are in there. And they potentially could die. So I knew that's an actual legal argument. So for him to charge me for a felony for it is ridiculous, especially when so many people died afterwards, you know. And I don't know the new sheriff's name, but I could tell as soon as she came on board, I saw immediate safety in the jail improve. I saw immediate cleanliness in the jail improve, and I saw less abuse. Like, I never got attacked in the jail after she was put on all the attacks, because I would get attacked in there because the guards would believe the propaganda about me that I'm just some wild anarchist rioter that needs to get put in their place. And so a lot of jail guard Trump supporters, you know, believed it was their place to put me to beat the crap out of me.
This is guards doing this.
Guards, yeah, guards. Okay. There were guards arrested too. It's not like, that's another thing. It's like, yeah, you could say I'm crazy and I'm saying all this because I'm crazy, but you could also go look up that guards have been arrested and found guilty for their crimes in that jail for hurting people, for purposely assaulting people. They just didn't investigate any protesters' cases. They only investigated like people that were snitches for the feds who got beat up by the jail guards that the feds off. That's how the whole investigation started with the DOJ, who went in there to enforce Mike Schmidt or whoever. I think Mike Schmidt was still the DA to charge the corrections officers with assault, and then the other ones with neglect. And one of the deaths, they were convicted.
Can you just clarify quick? Is the case around the alarm, is that still open?
Yes. Yes. What I'm going to be going on trial for and explaining to a jury that I was just trying to get justice for crimes committed against me, and I was just trying to save someone's life in the jail.
Was something happening at that moment?
No, just me playing it over and over in my head. I could hear them scream a lot sometimes, depending on what unit I was in, because fentanyl withdrawal is like a monster. It's not like, or at least it isn't, it sounds, even just sound, the way it sounds, different than just the normal heroin suffering withdrawal. It sounds a lot worse. And so I would, you know, like some, I've done pretty well dealing with it now, because I know I have to talk about it no matter what. But at that time, I sometimes would hear, you know, like could hear that noise.
Regarding the jail danger, you're kind of referring to the overall effects of both of, like,
yeah, they were putting people mentally ill who knew they were mentally ill in isolation cells with extra things they could use to unalive themselves. So, you know, like usually they're supposed to take your shoelaces stuff like that. They don't take your shoelaces. You know, for some people, it makes it a lot easier for them to do what they're going to do. They're doing stuff like that on purpose, which I found shocking. I don't know if it was out of, ignorance and neglect, or if it was on purpose, but it was an extremely dangerous thing to be doing.
You have the couple of cases open right now. Do you have, what sort of support do you have from the community around those?
Just recently I started getting really good support, but I still had to put lawyers on my credit card, because Multnomah County, to stick it to me even further, denied me a public defender because I had gotten a $5,000 check from the city for what they did to me in 2018, that attack they did to me. That money disgusted me, so I didn't touch it. It just stayed in my account. And because I didn't pay the bills, I had bills worth more than that, but I was dragging my feet on getting rid of that money. And they held that against me and denied me a court appointed attorney, even though I'm on a fixed income as a disabled veteran, and that's all I have. So that part's been the hardest.
Curious about it. Were they citing that as like an asset or something?
Yeah. And wow. Then I think later, because there are some times like I've been so upset and just don't care anymore that I will just not follow the court rules and just say what, you know, like I got dragged out of court. When I found out they were charging me for the kidnapping is wrong chalk, I flipped out in court and had to be dragged out. And then they just put down in the records I didn't show up to court. Like if you don't follow all the court's rules, they just write you down as you didn't show up and you get a warrant for your arrest.
Is there anything you would like to add about your experience in Portland that you'd like to say?
Yeah, I'm just one example, and my example isn't even as bad as it is. It's not as bad as it gets. And I just really wish that people who say they care about human rights cared about human rights in their own jail. They'll march around Portland for human rights 5,000 miles away, but they don't even know what's going on in their jail. And it's not just wrong, it's unlawful. I just wish people would pay attention, because anyone in Multnomah County has the right to go ask for a tour through the jail so they can see for themselves. And a lot of times, believe it or not, that actually helps, because you know they have to be on their best behavior and they have to clean this and clean that. And so it actually is helpful if people do that, if people exercise that right and say, I heard, you know, we've had a lot of deaths in the jail in 2023. I'd like to see, you know, what you're doing to change, you know, blah, 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 just whatever as a concerned citizen, because it's some of it is so easy to correct. And all it needs is a few powerful voices to stick up for what's going on in jail and what goes on against protesters, the targeting of protesters. I mean, doesn't anyone wonder? And maybe, you know, maybe a lot of Portland, they like this, but they pretty much killed the anarchist spirit in Portland. And guess how they did it? It wasn't through legal means. It was through a lot of abuse and a lot of torture and a lot of mistreatment, a lot of false charges.
I know you mentioned that under the new sheriff, you've seen the jail get a little bit better. But I mean, taking into account, you know, that Nate Vasquez is now the DA and there's a lot more calls for increased arrests and police officers and chargeable misdemeanors and felonies around possession. Do you see it continuing to get better, or?
No, it just gets worse. It gets much worse, because the worst place you could put somebody severely mentally ill going through withdrawal is jail. I mean, I've seen so many people in there that really, like, obviously needed to be in a hospital. And the, you know, having this idea, we're just going to put them in jail and teach them what they need to learn or whatever. We don't have the same rights as a dog in the dog pound in there. Like, it would be safer to go lock them in the dog pound, because they're going to get water there. There's people who die in our jails from no water. I mean, really, we're going to you're such an annoying nuisance on our streets that we're just going to stick you in a box and then not give you water until you're out of our life anymore. Like, it would be more humane to put suicide booths everywhere. It would be more humane to do that than to what they are doing to people in the jail is unbelievable. And there's no medical. Like, I used to get medical when I would get arrested and I would go to jail. I would get medical. Now I don't get that. I don't get any meds or anything, even though they have them all on my list, because they're the VA and the jail have their computers interlinked or whatever, because there's so many veterans that end up in jail from their mental problems. But yeah, they're so no medication, no, which is dangerous for people with heart disease and high blood pressure. I mean, that's why people are, young people are dying in the jail too, is because their medical symptoms are just being ignored.
And you mentioned a bit about the people's ability to take tours of the jail. What are some things that people can do to improve what's happening, if anything?
Taking the tour is like something pretty simple that you could do. And like, the higher your social status is, the better it's going to be for you to take tours through there. And I don't know what else. I mean, there needs to be some kind of jail support. Like, since I've gone in and out of the jail so many times, I've seen so many things that are so dangerous. Like, I've seen them dump a guy in a wheelchair out into freezing cold, an elderly disabled guy. I've seen like really cognitively impaired young people come out of jail that could get a predator could get really easy, you know. There needs to be some, there's so many people that want to really, when they get out of jail, they really do want to do good. They really want to stay sober. Like, they finally made it through withdrawal. They want to make a better turn. But then they get out of jail and all that's there are drug dealers. There's no one there saying, hey, you want to go to a clean and sober house? Do you want to try this? Do you want to try that? There's nothing like that. It's all straight back into the fentanyl field. There's no help to get you from point A to point B. And if your brain isn't as good as everyone else's, you know, that step from getting out of jail to the clean and sober house or to a treatment program is